Thursday, July 23rd, the year 2020. I have survived the first rose ceremony, but at what cost? I fear now that I am part of something darker than I could have ever imagined. I cannot say how many hours have passed since the producers have taken control of every aspect of my existence, but after a seemingly endless barrage of planned events, interrogations, and contrived conversations with other suitors, I have finally been allowed back to my room for much-needed rest. My hand trembles from exhaustion as I commit my memories to paper, and I fear I will be claimed by a deep slumber in the moments to come. But I will record what I can until I can no more. After being hustled down a long hallway by a team of nameless masked producers, I was stuffed into the back of a limousine where I encountered seven other men, one of whom was clad head to toe in a full body costume. He was a skunk. For several moments after the door was shut and locked behind me, we all sat and stared at one another in silence. Each of us evaluating the others as potential threats in the game that had now begun. Finally, a muscular man named Chris T reached his hand toward me and said,
"Hey, I'm Chris T. Welcome aboard."
As though he were any more the steward of this vessel than any of us. But with the ice broken, we each exchanged names and short anecdotes about the process that had landed each of us in this position. Notably, Dan, the occupant of the skunk costume, lamented his choice for comedy, and I was relieved to have foregone my own hot dog costume for a more general purpose fitted Hugo Boss three-piece. Before Dan could explain the factors that led to his lamentable decision, the limo lurched forward, and momentarily we turned a corner to arrive at the front entrance of the La Quinta Resort, where, standing on a freshly dampened driveway, was Miss Crawley herself. After 6 days of forced isolation with no human contact, she appeared to me as an angel of mercy, shining in the darkness of the deep desert night. A producer's voice sounded on some hidden speaker from within the limousine.
"Chris T, you're up first. The door will open, you will get out, approach Claire, spend no more than 2 minutes with her, and then proceed into the front entrance of the resort. Do not deviate from this pattern of behavior."
I was envious of Chris T being gifted the prize of first meeting, but simultaneously, I was glad to be able to wait and watch, to possibly gain information from whoever would be forced into this ceremonial meeting before me. Chris T's strategy was unremarkable, I thought. A few words followed by a planned ballroom dance move that ended predictably in a dip. I watched with the rest of our dwindling group as four more men made their limo exits, most notably, Dan tripped and fell over his own skunk tail as he proceeded toward Miss Crawley. The shame of the accident must have been immense because his face turned a shade of crimson so deep that we could see it through the tinted windows of the limousine. When my name was called, it rang like a bell in my mind.
"Charles, you're up."
The door was opened and I stepped out into the night. I took a deep breath, and even though the heat of the desert air stung my lungs, it was clean and crisp, a welcome change from the stale environs of the room that had become my cell over the past days. I felt weightless as I moved toward the fair Miss Crawley, and I cannot remember the feeling of the earth beneath my feet. It was as if the world around us dropped away, and I was pulled to her shimmering visage by an unseen force, floating through space and time to find myself finally standing before her, smiling. We stood for a moment, staring into one another's eyes, and I did not realize how beguiled I had been until it was her that had to utter the first words.
"Hi, I'm Claire,"
she said as she put out her hand, smiling and laughing. Her charm was intoxicating, the kind of nonchalant confidence you might expect from a movie star or professional athlete. I laughed in return. "Hello, I'm Charles," I said as I took her hand in mine, and instead of shaking it, I brought it to my lips and watched as she blushed and curtsied, then said,
"Oh my, what a gentleman."
"Indeed," I replied and continued. "I'm a florist by trade, and I work with beautiful things all day long, but I have never beheld anything as lovely as you look here tonight under the pale desert moon."
"Oh, well, thank you,"
she said, and then we embraced. I made my muscles taut to accentuate my physique as she pressed herself to me, and I was rewarded by hearing Miss Crawley give the slightest inhale with her face next to my neck. She was undisputedly enjoying my selection of Nautica Voyage, which I had hoped would arouse her senses. As the embrace separated back into two people standing before one another, I took her hands in mine and said, "I look forward to talking more tonight."
"Oh, me too,"
she said as she cocked her head to one side. I felt confident she didn't recognize me as the fool in a hot dog costume from a few days prior. Just before I entered the resort, I looked back over my shoulder to get one last gaze of her standing there, only to see that she too was looking back at me. It was a brief but meaningful exchange that I hoped would translate into safety that night. Upon entering the lobby of the La Quinta Resort, a group of producers skittered around at my feet, all of them masked. I could scarcely tell one from the next as they hurried me to an open bar where a few other men were already partaking in the endless waterfall of alcohol to which we now had access. I declined the offer, despite the unending insistence of these blasted producers that I have at least one drink. But I am nothing if not a student of this game, and I have seen one time too many the ill effects of overindulgence at this very moment. Night one, you see, is the most brutal and unforgiving night in all 10 rounds of this game. I knew that fully a third of us would be sent home on that night. If Miss Crawley saw any reason for concern at all, she was well within her rights to dismiss any one of us without giving so much as a word of an explanation. Giving in to the temptation of drink was simply one of many possible traps that would have to be avoided on that night. So I ordered a Shirley Temple and made my way into a large common area where the other men had begun to congregate. As the night wore on and the group grew in size, I tried to remain inert, never giving any of them cause to single me out as a potential threat, and never giving the producers any indication that I might be put to work in any of the schemes they were no doubt concocting to sabotage various suitors' strategies. Once each of us made our entries, a hush fell over the room as Miss Crawley herself entered and joined us in the common area. She delivered an impeccable first speech, making it clear that she was taking this process very seriously, and that she was beyond hopeful her future husband was indeed in this very room. How my heart did race at the thought of it, the possibility that I could be the very man about whom she was speaking. No sooner than the final syllable had fallen from her supple lips Did a man named O'Brien whisk her off for the first one-on-one conversation? While this strategy is certainly tried and true, I have always felt it ran the risk of seeming desperate and overly anxious. Better to lie in the cut, I thought, and pick the right moment. So I milled about, had a few conversations about nothing in particular, and tried to absorb as much information as I could about the emerging social group dynamic. The shortest among us, Paul, seemed to be attempting to establish himself as the alpha by browbeating as many of us as possible into arm-wrestling competitions. This was a fool's errand, and I steered clear of him altogether. Ben had taken up permanent residence at the piano in the lobby, and although he had some talent, he either could not recognize or did not care that the instrument was out of tune, and so too were his attempts at properly playing a truncated collection of Billy Joel's greatest hits. Javier had brought with him a pack of playing cards, with which he had performed a rather impressive series of prestidigitations upon meeting Miss Crawley. He attempted to hold court with his talents for sleight of hand, but I paid him no mind. And poor Dan was ostracized. He sat by the fireplace, sweating into his skunk costume, wondering, I'm sure, why he made such a fatal error from the very first moment. A man called Duncan had revealed himself to be a mortician. In a clear effort to offset the grim nature of his profession, he was admittedly fond of wearing Hawaiian shirts and outrageously colored ties. This overcorrection was not just present in his wardrobe, but also in his sense of humor. Not a word came from his mouth that wasn't some rudimentary form of pun or one-liner. I thought of all the other suitors here, and he seemed the one most likely to register an adverse reaction from Miss Crawley, so I set about watching him very carefully and planned to make my steal as their conversation was coming to a close. He began pacing, working up the nerve to do what he knew he had to do. What we all had to if we wanted time with Miss Crawley. He went to the bar and downed a shot of brown liqueur, slapped himself in the face, and then marched outside to initiate a steal of his own. I followed some feet behind, using shrubs and decorative architectural features to obfuscate my clandestine mission. Duncan located Miss Crawley sitting on a nearby bench watching a man whose name I could not remember doing a handstand. Duncan was respectful enough to let this man return to a full upright position before he interrupted.
Claire, can I steal you for a second?
The exchange of power was peaceful, and Duncan began his conversation. Although I could clearly hear every word said between them, it was still a difficult conversation to listen to. Duncan was clearly no expert in the genteel art of verbal discourse, and his attempts to engage Miss Crawley with details about his line of work had a visibly off-putting effect. I let poor Duncan continue his inadvertent self-sabotage. Just until I saw Miss Crawley yawn, and I knew this was the time to strike. So I emerged from the shadows as if by magic and stepped in. Excuse me, Duncan, would you mind terribly if I was to have a brief chat with Miss Crawley? The man seemed almost relieved at my arrival, as he said,
All yours, Deuter.
Before leaning in for a poorly executed hug. As he left, I reached out to Miss Crawley and took her by the hand and said, I don't suppose you'd fancy a walk around the property.
Oh, I'd love that,
she said with a smile. My strategy served a double purpose. Not only was I taking her away from that bench where she had just suffered through a fool's attempt at courtship, but I was turning her into a moving target for any future interlopers, which I reasoned would grant me more time with her, even if slight. After a few steps, I extended my elbow nearest Miss Crawley, and she looped her arm through instinctively. I sensed that she rather enjoyed this formal show of respectful affection. Our conversation was pleasant. I omitted any mention of COVID-19 or the state of the world, and instead focused on her and my desire to start the next phase of my life with the right person. After some minutes, I could hear rustling in a nearby bush, and I knew the next suitor was poised to make his move. So I stopped and turned to face Miss Crawley, using the final moments to their fullest. "You are the sole reason I decided to throw myself into this whirlwind experience. I just wanted you to know that. And as of right now, I couldn't be happier to be here so that I might get to know you better," I said with all due sincerity. Never breaking eye contact with me, she smiled and replied,
"I feel the exact same way."
And then we kissed. It was slow and sweet, and in that moment the cameras and masked minions in the shadows all seemed to disappear. It was just Miss Crawley and I there, under the stars of the desert sky, sharing a moment. And then that moment was interrupted by Dan, who stumbled around a corner and fell again on the ground in his skunk suit. The commotion was enough to bring our moment to a close, but not before we shared one last glance. Then I helped Dan to his feet before returning inside, certain that I had performed well in this first, most important moment, alone with Miss Crawley. Before I could return to the group, a masked fellow pulled me aside into an unmarked room, then shut and locked the door behind me. There was a camera set up with two other masked entities sitting on either side of it.
"Sit down,"
one of them commanded. I did as instructed.
"We're going to ask you a series of questions. You will look directly into the lens of the camera and answer them by repeating the phrasing used in the questions. For example, if we ask, 'What is your favorite color?' you will respond, 'My favorite color is blue.' Is this clear?"
"Yes," I said. All feelings I had of romance and hope replaced by fear and confusion.
"Question number one, what was the kiss with Claire like?"
"For me, it was magical. A moment rarely shared between two people that had the transformative power of deep connection wrapped in the tingling excitement that can only come from the hopeful possibility of falling in love."
"Again,"
the masked figure barked.
"But repeat the question."
"Right. It was an honest mistake," I said in my own defense.
"We don't have time for mistakes tonight,"
the other one said. I repeated it back as they wanted and set through dozens of other questions. I was asked things like who I thought had the biggest problem with alcohol in the pool of suitors, who I thought was most likely to be a virgin, even who I would most like to see die. It was a strange series of questions, and I was told I could not leave this room until I answered them all satisfactorily. I have no idea how long I was held against my will, but once I was finally released into the main room, there was scarcely enough time to see that Chris T had received the first impression rose, much to everyone's dismay, before I heard three sharp tones. Shrill as the cry of an eagle, I turned and looked to the source, and there he was, standing in the vestibule, holding a silver knife and a half-full champagne flute. It was Chris Harrison. My eyes darted away from him. It was a reaction beyond my control, triggered by the memory of this man standing in the heat as he sucked the life from a nearby cactus. I had convinced myself this event never took place. But now, as he stood there with that terrible grin full of row after row of glistening teeth, I wasn't so sure.
"Gentlemen," he said, "hopefully all of you had enough time with Claire, because now it's time for our first rose ceremony."
I was positioned on the back riser just behind Duncan in his skunk costume, the bushy tail pushed against my thighs. It was an experience I had seen many times, but was not fully prepared for. Without food and forced to stand stone still for hours on end while they shot and reshot some of the first row's presentations, I became lightheaded and thought I might be rendered unconscious. But as soon as I heard Miss Crawley call out my name, all of my faculties came back to me in a rush. I marched straight to her, accepted my first rose, and gave her a very polite kiss on the cheek before returning to my perch with my prize. I watched as she carved through the rest of the names until there were none left, and once again Chris Harrison emerged.
"Gentlemen," he said, "if you did not receive a rose, please say your goodbyes."
And so they did. Among them was Duncan. I felt specific sympathy for him, knowing that I easily could have been in the same boat had I made one choice differently. Chris Harrison lingered there in the room like a stone gargoyle, his unflinching gaze taking each of us in, weighing us against some scale known only to him. I hadn't realized I was staring at him until his eyes snapped to me and our gazes were locked. I wanted to look away at anything other than those piercing eyes. They were the same as I had seen in the courtyard, glowing, a world of fire and chaos churning inside them. Staring into those soulless orbs caused me to hold my breath for some unknown reason, and I could feel darkness creeping in at the edges of my vision. Then, just before I lost consciousness, he smiled at me and looked away. I gasped for air, trying to hide my oxygen-deprived condition from the others, as Chris Harrison casually walked around a corner and disappeared. The sun had come up to cast its unbearable heat down onto the desert, and those of us that remained joined Miss Crawley for a speech and a toast, and then the producers emerged to chaperone each of us back to our rooms, which is where more than all other events I have described, the most chilling occurrence has taken place. Shortly after I returned to this room, I heard 9 screams from somewhere outside. These screams came from men trapped in the throes of terror and pain. They were each from a different man, and they each occurred only once. Can it be merely coincidence that the number of men who did not receive a rose on this night also numbers 9?